For those of you who don't know Bill passed away, and Microsoft PowerPoint has stopped working. But Bill passed away this week. He died of a heart attack walking home from Circle K. His memorial service will be on Saturday at 1 o'clock at Christ Presbyterian Church, which is at 6565 East Broadway. So it's Broadway and Wilmot, 6565. You'll get an email giving you directions. There'll be a big obituary, you know, in the newspaper. So there'll be a lot of information on how to celebrate Bill. When I found out about this, I was pretty far into preparing for this message. And so I was thinking about, do I need to change the message? And as I was thinking through that, and I was talking to my kids, when I told them that Bill had passed, they were very insistent that they get to go to the memorial service. And that was the first thing that came out of their mouth. And when I went and sat with his sisters, they started showing me emails on how Bill had advised them on how to parent their kids. Long emails that I read with lots of Bible verses instructing them on how to parent their kids. And the one thing I know about the last conversation I had with Bill was about Native American children on the reservation and their struggle to get off. So I know Bill really, really cares about kids, and the kids here at the village can attest to that. So I think Bill would be very honored for me to talk about parenting and to talk about what might be said in the Bible about being a parent. So tonight, though, while I was preparing, I was looking at a lot of what Jesus has to say about kids, and I was looking at, you know, what the Old Testament Proverbs has to say about kids, and I felt like the Holy Spirit kept saying to me, you need to talk about parenting out of Psalm 23. It's kind of an odd psalm to talk about parenting. But tonight what we're going to do is I'm going to cover the first half of Psalm 23, and we're going to talk about what it means to be a parent in the context of this psalm. So if you have a Bible, there are Bibles all over the place. Now, here I know when I decide to talk about parenting, that means a whole bunch of you are going to be like, okay, well, I don't have kids. Well, hopefully a lot of you want to have kids, others of you can't. They're all in different places. But I guarantee you that tonight God will speak to you. And if nothing else, what you can hear is how God is parenting you. So we're going to start Psalm 23. Psalm 23 starts this way. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. In John chapter 10, Jesus tells us that he is the good shepherd, and that we are his sheep, and the sheep hear his voice. So you could read this, the Lord, or Jesus, is my good shepherd, and I shall not want. Now, to understand the picture of this verse, I want you to think about, most of us here know Evie. She's a little wee widow girl. She just started walking and talking. Her mom is named Erin. Now, for some reason, I am the personification of evil to Evie. If I go to her house, if she's headed in the door, as soon as she sees me, she finds mom and grabs hold of mom and buries her head in mom's leg. And if mom's carrying her, she gets like this and won't look at me. I've never done anything to Evie other than be me, which I don't know what that is. But to her, I represent some kind of danger. And this is the picture of this psalm, is when the psalmist says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, what he's saying is that when I have hold of tight of Jesus, of God, my head is buried in his leg or in his chest, I'm at peace. To not to want anything is to be at peace. have peace. Now, as a parent, and this is God's desire for us as children, but as a parent, my desire for my kids is that they grow up to say this verse, that this is what they can say. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. A lot of us want for our parents, or for our children not to have, you know, a lot of strife or struggle. And that's good to wish those things, but the biblical longing that we should have for our children is that they be in a place where they can say, I have a relationship with God and I have peace. That's what I want for my kids. Now here's the thing, for most of us, we have trouble ourselves being able to say that, let alone having our kids say that. On occasion I get artistic and I draw graphs. So I drew this graph. Recently, we've been talking about in the Psalms about God being good and our misunderstanding of goodness. That goodness isn't just that he's morally right or transcendent, but the word is actually an eating word. That God tastes good, that he smells good, that he sounds good, that he feels good. For those of you who know in the New Testament, the writer John in his letter says, basically, we hugged Jesus, we heard Jesus, we tasted Jesus' fish, we were with him, we can tell you about it. For God to be good, that's a relational word. So in this graph, as you can see, if you start out at a place where your relational engagement is zero, then your sense of God's goodness is zero. That really, your understanding of God's goodness is connected to your relational engagement with God, your willingness to taste and hear and see and smell and put your whole self into relationship with God. And that's what you're hoping as a parent your children move towards. That they're people who taste and smell and grab hold of Jesus and can say he's good and can say that they have no want. Now the psalmist is gonna talk about what it looks like to be shepherded by God. Now I want to tell you something before we get started. I'm going to use a little bit of language here. Not bad language, but sheep are dumb. Okay? So for God to be our shepherd, there's an implication that we have some dumbness to us. Okay, now children are really dumb. So if you're like, if you're 0 to 21, I'm going to call you dumb right now, and then I'll change it to unwise. Okay? Children are very, very unwise. Depending on their age, they may have a little bit more wisdom to them, but they're unwise. And they require a lot of guidance and a lot of shepherding. And so the writer David is actually going to talk about how he appreciates being shepherded by God. And if you don't have children, here's a great opportunity just to think through about how God has moved in your life this way. If you do have children, we're going to just talk about how you're an instrument of these things in your kid's life. If you aren't a follower of Jesus, this is your opportunity to see how Jesus would move into your life and work on it. Verse 2 says, he makes me lie down in green pastures. He makes me lie down in green pastures. Green pastures are comfortable places to lay down, so they're good. So whatever the shepherd makes us do, it's good. Now in our culture, we have this, we don't like to make our children do things. We don't like to make anybody do anything. Because when you attempt to make somebody do something, they will push back on you. And they will withdraw relationship from you. And then it will make it very uncomfortable. And yet what the writer here says is that the shepherd makes these sheep lay down in a good place. Now, one of the reasons that you and I don't like to be made to do things is because usually when we're being made to do something, it's for the other person's own good. They're trying to make you be quiet because you're too loud, or they're trying to, you know, make you stop doing something because it's embarrassing to them. But here, the object of being a shepherd, the object of being a parent, is to make your children do things that are good for them, that are going to make life good for them, where they're going to grow. Now, the reason that you would make a sheep lay down, or the reason they won't lay down, there's a couple reasons. But number one, sheep will not lay down when they think there's a predator out there. Basically, when sheep are afraid, they won't lay down. The other thing is that when sheep are distracted, sheep have this special fly that flies in their nose and lays eggs, and it's very annoying to them. And Rod's going to hopefully speak on the second half of Psalm 23, and he'll explain why that all works out there. But these flies are annoying to them, and so it's hard for them to relax. And the other one is that sheep are just like any animal. They have a pecking order. Only sheep are dumb, so they headbutt each other. Headbutting is the way that they keep, you know, order. I was just today watching a show on Bedouins in Israel, and so they showed some scenes with sheep, and the sheep are headbutting each other, and the shepherd's in there with a stick whacking them in the head as they're headbutting everybody. So sheep, but here's the thing, so sheep are really just selfish animals, and they can't lay down unless everything is lined up perfectly, right? Well, these three aspects are good things to just think about in parenting. Number one, you will not be able to make your children do things if they're afraid. Now, you might get them to obey in the moment, but if there is fear in the home and in your relationship, they won't obey. So if you're up in their face yelling at them and trying and shaming them and pouring contempt on them to try to get them to do what you want them to do, it won't work, because they'll be afraid. Children do not like to obey out of fear. They will eventually rebel. They might, as long as they think you're stronger than them or there's no way out, they'll try to stay in line enough to keep themselves safe. But they're not going to obey. They're not going to rest in green pastures. The other thing is if you create in your family a context of fear where there's lots of arguing and lots of strife, again, it's going to be difficult for that child to obey. Second, I don't know if you've noticed this, but children from 0 to 18, they're very distractible. Well, 18 to 25, or all of us. But, you know, children are very distractible. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. Yeah, squirrel. But I don't know, there's this thing in my house, and it goes from Elliot, who's the littlest, to Jesse, who's the oldest. If you ask them to do something, they're going to do it, but they always want to do a set of things beforehand. Empty the garbage. Can I take a shower first? Elliot, clean your room. Where is he? He's outside picking up his skates. I'm like, why are you picking up your skates? Well, I need to do that before I clean my room. Like, it's not that they don't want to obey, but immediately you tell them to do something and they're distractible. Part of it is Paul talks about this in the New Testament, that before we know Jesus, we're just given to our impulses, and that Jesus comes and begins to discipline us. Well, children are really little non-humans, and parents are about humanizing them. And to be a human is to actually have self-regulation and be able to follow directions and to be direct. So one of the jobs in getting your children to obey is understanding their distractions and being willing to say, oh, no, go do that. No, you can pick your skates up later. No, you don't. You can get the drink later. Right, that's Elliot's favorite thing. Go clean your room. He's going to go get a drink first. No, have a drink after the room is clean. Part of that is like, well, that seems silly. No, but it's teaching him self-regulation. Okay, I can do this, but this is the most important thing. Go clean my room. Right? Children are very, very distractible. The third thing is, these, you know, sheep are headbutting each other, but with kids, the two things that kids are selfish and unkind. Yeah, I'm sure some of your kids are nice, but there's a reason we call egocentrism a child thing. Children only know one thing, themselves. Right? Just over at my brother's house, and he was talking about how his oldest daughter is, he just said bluntly, she's selfish. She wants all of Moses' toys, and she won't give them back to him. And so he was telling me how he was working on removing her selfishness. Right? That's typical. But also in the community of children, even if you have one or many, children tend to be unkind to each other. you know, I duct tape my brothers to the bunk beds. We did, you know, I'd set up a boxing ring and make my two brothers fight, and then when my big brother started beating up my little brother, then I'd jump in and beat up my big, you know, the middle son. It was just, right, we're not nice to each other. If you just, you know, my brother sat down once when Wes came back from Tennessee, and we were all chatting about all the horrible things that I did to them. Because I was the biggest, so I did most of the horrible things. Of course, they broke all of my stuff in revenge, but anyway. But the reality is the children aren't kind, and they're into themselves. And our job, if you want them to obey, then you have to train them to be other-centered and kind. That is your goal as a parent. Other-centered, kind. So here, you know, if your child is not kind to his brothers and sisters or his friends, a good discipline is simply to make them do kind things for their siblings. To put aside what they want to do and to offer something that the other person wants to do. But so if you want your kids to obey, those are some things to think about. Now, here's the thing about making. Making is okay. You can make your kids do things. It's okay to make them go to church. It's okay to make them do chores. As long as the motivation in what you're making children do, not to make you look good and to remove embarrassment from you. If whatever you're making your child do is because they're going to find a green pasture, a place of peace. Because when children are in a place of peace, there's no fear. They're able to handle their distractions, and they are becoming other-centered. So it's okay to make your children do stuff. The shepherd makes us do stuff. The second part of verse 2 says, he leads me beside quiet waters. Sheep do not like busy waters. They are not good swimmers, but it's not about sheep being good swimmers. Sheep are woolly. And if they get in the water, they sink. Right? So they do not want to be in the water because they're going to sink. The other thing that when the reason says that the shepherd leads is that if you ever try to drive sheep, they don't go in a straight line. They go out like this. And if you ever try to drive a child to do something, you get in their room and you badger them, it only works for a few minutes because children just kind of scatter. Badgering your child will not be successful. You have to lead your child, meaning you have to go out in front of them. In that, I came up with just five ways I thought that you could think about as a parent how you might be a good leader to your children. Number one, and these are good just if you're a leader, but number one is you need to learn from your mistakes. Now, I think it's very important with your children, especially as they get older, as you make mistakes, to sit down and talk to them about them, your mistakes. But more importantly, the reason you would learn from your mistakes is parenting is a strategic thing. It's not kind of like, whatever happens. You really actually have to think and plan out what you're doing and where you're going and what's the direction you're bringing your children to. Because your whole goal is to get them in a place where they know Jesus in a way that they can say, I have no want. But I would tell you that more important, as you think strategically, but more important than telling your children you're sorry or you made a mistake, is actually to go to your community and to your friends, and in particular people who are older than you, and say, you know what? This thing isn't working for me. This is what I've been doing with my kids. I think it's not working. What do you think? Now, I do this in a really sly way, and I have to confess that I haven't actually said I make a mistake to other people. But I go to my parents' house, and they're here, so I have to confess this in front of them. But I go to my parents' house, and I'll just talk about what I'm doing. Now, my mom, in particular, my dad sometimes, are going to tell me what they think. And so then what I'm doing is gathering data, because it's what I do. I gather data to make decisions. So I'm gathering data from mom and dad, and then I go back and change things. I don't use everything they said. So really, that's how I confess my mistakes. But it's really important, I think, to bring other people into your parenting and let them reflect how they would experience what you're doing. Because it'll give you a lot of perspective. You know, ask peers, find someone who's a little ahead of you and ask them what they think. And even if you don't necessarily agree completely with their parenting style, they're going to give you a lot of good information if you're willing to offer that to them. Number two, you need to lead by example. You cannot ask your children to do something that you're unwilling to do. Now this is actually a little tricky though, because your children, for instance, let's just say you have a teenager and you're wrestling with them because they don't want to go to school or they don't want to get a job. There's a fear thing for them out in the world. And you're like, go get a job. I went out and got a job. Why can't you do that? Or go to school, whatever. You need to be very careful, because just because you were able to face that fear doesn't mean that in other places in your life you're not facing that fear, right? That they can look and say, well, hey, yeah, you did that, but look at these other places, Dad, where you're a mom, where you're doing, you're not facing your fear, and you're asking me to. So when you're leading, you have to realize that what you're asking your children to do is not just one, it's not linear. There's a lot of areas. But the other thing is, children watch, and the more that they participate with you, they learn. So one of the things I like to do in my family is I really, really want my children to be in a place where they come to me and say, when Sue and I are doing dishes or cleaning or making food, to say, is there anything I can do to help? Which has been really cool, because Elliot has just started doing that. But the way that I teach that then is, when we go to other people's houses, I say to them, when my family is around, is there anything we can do to help? And on occasion, I go into their bedrooms and I say, hey, is there any way I can help you clean your room? What can I do? And so I'm trying to get them into a culture, have them imitate what I'm doing. So you need to lead by example. You need to be willing to do what you're asking people to do. Number three is, to be a good parent or to be a good leader, is you have to be other-centered. When Jesus was asked to sum up everything in the Old Testament, he said the whole Old Testament is basically love God with everything, love your neighbor as yourself. A good leader is someone who loves God with everything and loves their neighbor as theirself. If you have a very selfish lifestyle, your children will not be able to get through to you. See, what happens is as parents, we get wrapped up in our children and we get wrapped up in our own life, and we have all these idols, like the idol of our television, our free time, the way our children act. I mean, you and I can go on and on with a list of things, and if you think about your parents, you can think about all their things, their idols that made it difficult for you to be in a relationship with them. But what happens is that when we're so centered on ourselves, our kids can't even get through all of our idols to actually have a relationship with us. And so if you want to have a culture of children who can say, I stand with Jesus and I don't have any want, then you have to be willing to face your own idols. How your kids make you look. You know, having very vocal children and having an 11-year-old puts me often in embarrassing situations because they just say things. And for me, one of my idols is that I want life to appear a certain way. I want people to think about me as a parent and as a pastor in a certain way. My kids consistently ruin that for me. Okay? My community is rather gracious to me, right? But honestly, we're all kids and we've all ruined it for mom and dad, but as a parent, we certainly have to deal with that. So if we create a culture of other-centeredness, then our relationships are focused on Jesus, and that's the link between us as a family and as children. The fourth one is to have confidence. Children can smell fear, and children can smell doubt. And if you decide that this is the way it's going to be, here's the consequence, these are the rules of the house, if they sense that you doubt it a little bit or there's some kind of conflict between you and mom and dad, they will begin to manipulate it. And they'll work the angles from like 0 to 25, right? they're going to work the angles. And one of the things in our culture is that we, because we've kind of deconstructed right and wrong, for some good, but for a lot of bad, none of us are really confident that we know the right thing. But it's been proven, actually, that if you're genuine, your gut feeling is usually the right thing. Like, if you think, my son shouldn't do this, or these are the consequences, go with it, be confident that that's what you're supposed to do. Because when you're confident, and when you stick with it, your children will follow you. Because confidence provides safety. I like to follow people who, even if they don't know what they're doing, seem like they know what they're doing, right? Because it feels safe. And the one thing kids are constantly asking is, am I safe? Is this a safe place for me to be me? When you have parents who are willing to be strong and wrong sometimes, it's good. This last one might be a little controversial, but I would argue that you need to set high standards. In our culture, we are at a place where we're like, well, this kid has this capacity and this kid has that capacity. That's true. But you still need to set high standards. I'll give you a simple example. For instance, a high standard would be you should get all A's. That's a really high standard. Right? You should tell your children. And this is just an example. You don't have to go with this one. But you should get all A's. So your kid comes back and they have B's and an A. You don't shame them and say, oh, you're so stupid, you didn't get A's, how could you possibly have done this? No, you say, good job, and I'm really proud of the work you put in. And, you know, if there's some stuff that they need to work on, you can chat about that. But not in that moment, but in the context of your family and the family values, you still need to hold up, you should get all A's. Now you look at me probably and say, well, that's unfair. Well, you know, God says to us, be holy like I am holy. That's unfair. Because he knows that I can't be holy. And yet he says, I have to be holy. The good thing about high standards is not that you bring shame and guilt on people. It's actually an opportunity for grace. It's an opportunity to show your children that there's grace in life. That even though they can't reach the mark, you still love them. There's a mark, but you love them. And you're going to encourage them in the places that they need to be encouraged, challenged, and disciplined, but there's still a high mark. Now, that doesn't have to be grades. Grades is just an easy one to kind of illustrate that. As a good leader, you want to set high standards. Children, adults, we all will raise to the standard that's put in front of us. We may not always make it, but we will strive for it. And if it's in a loving environment, we'll keep working at it. And what happens is you end up teaching your children how to work hard. Verse 3, first part of it says, he restores my soul. The shepherd restores my soul. Literally, this means he returns me to me. If you look at restore being a return idea, a soul being human, what it's saying is he returns us to being human. So if you imagine, like I said, that children are unhuman, right? And that part of parenting is humanizing. What Jesus did for us on the cross, because when we walked out of the garden and we were disobedient, the further history goes on, the more unhuman we become. And Jesus and the cross and the resurrection goes boom, and all of a sudden you and I have an opportunity to begin to return to humanity, to what it was supposed to be like. As a parent, we're an instrument in kids' life to bring them to humanness. Now, when a sheep gets pregnant, or its wool gets really big, or it gets in a clover field, usually it falls over. Sheep fall over all the time. Once a sheep has fallen over, it cannot get back up. It gets full of gas, and it will die. So shepherds are always on the look for sheep that have fallen over, and they run to get them. And they pick them up, and they warm up their legs to get the circulation going. And they're probably talking to the sheep, even though the sheep has no idea what they're saying. But they're restoring the sheep to its uprightness. Now, that is a redemptive thing. That is a salvation thing. So as a parent, You and I are called to be redemptive agents in our children's lives. We are looking for them to fall over. They are unwise. They will fall over. Right? You've seen children even when they're walking. When they first start to walk, their heads are way too big for them. And they get started, and then they just pitch over, and they run real fast, and boom, they hit their head. That is kind of children's life in a metaphor, right? That there is this heaviness, they're going to fall over, they're going to do stupid things. Now, the author of a book, I think it's called Shepherding a Child's Heart, Ted Tripp, he tells a great example of what this looks like and what it would look like to restore your children, and in a way, how you bring the gospel, Jesus' story, to bear in your children's lives. So this is how he tells it. His son, who was 16, lied to his dad and said, I am going to go and spend the night on Saturday or Friday night with my friend. Really, he was going to a party. So he got his friend to lie for him, and he went to the party. The next day, his son comes home, goes down into his bedroom, and Ted gets a call, the dad, and it's the mother of the kid, and the mom says, my son just told me that he lied and that your son didn't spend the night. He was at a party. So he gets off the phone, and he's really angry, like any parent would be, really, really angry. And so he goes up into the bedroom with his where his wife is, and he says, guess where our son was, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, well, I think you should pray. He's like, I don't want to pray for him. She's like, no, you need to pray for you. And so as he started praying, what he realized was that God had pressed in on the conscience of this young boy so that he would confess his lie. But then pressed in on the conscience of this mother who called to tell him. So God, he figured out, was already at work restoring his son. His opportunity in restoration was to join Jesus in that process. Before I tell you the rest of the story, that's the cool thing to restoration and parenting, is a lot of times, especially as our children get older, we want to be the one who fixes it for them. We want to fix everything for them, and we think that it bears a lot on us to do it. But the reality is that Jesus is already shepherding your child. Your job is to figure out where he's doing it, probably where you're getting angry. God's working around that. So Ted goes downstairs, asks his son to turn the music off, and he says to him, you know, on days like this, do you ever think God's grace is good? Kid's like, not really, no. It's like, on particular days like this, do you think God's grace is good? And the kid looks at his dad and says, who told you? And he said that he looked at his son and he said, you know, most of the time you live your life in the light. But right now you're living your life in the darkness, and I don't want you to live in the darkness. And then he turned around and walked out of the room. And he heard his son say, Dad, don't go. I want to live in the light, but it's so hard. Will you help me? Now that's a magical moment that maybe one of us will get to have in this room with our children, right? And then when you get that magical moment, you're going to write a bunch of books and it's going to make you a lot of money. But what's important in that magical moment is that the parent was humbled and he realized that it wasn't up to him to fix his son. It was up to him to bring God's story, God's grace to his kid, to put reality out there, but just to join Jesus in what he already was doing. So to encourage you, if you're frustrated with your child, even from 2 to 25, or maybe even if they're 40, the question you have to ask as you're struggling is, God, what are you doing? Where are you moving? How are you already shepherding them? And how can I jump in and join you in that? So that's how you become an agent of Jesus in your kids' lives. We'll finish up here. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Now, for his name's sake literally means because that's his character, who he is. God shepherds us, leads us on the right path, because that's what God does. Now, guiding is interesting because guiding is about teaching. To guide someone, you have to teach them. But to teach them, you have to be able to teach them about what you know. In 2 Timothy 3:16, and I'm just going to, does anybody want to quote that for me before I get there? And the paraphrase of that is, God's word does a lot of good parenting of us. That when I want to work on my relationship with my wife, the Bible actually is one of the best places for me to go. When I'm on a parent, well, everything that I want to do in life is around Jesus and Scripture. It's full of good things that way. So if you're going to be able to teach your child to move towards Jesus in a way where he can say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, you have to be willing to teach them. You have to teach them what you know, meaning you have to be willing to do the work to engage in a relationship with Jesus. Now, here's the thing about teaching. When I first became a pastor, I thought that when you preached, that you were supposed to, like, never teach the same thing, and everything should be inventive, and you should be really creative, and you shouldn't repeat yourself. And what I found out is that nobody listens to you, and you need to repeat yourself over and over again, right? That people who are listening to a guy talk, they're only gonna remember three or four things I said today, maybe, if you're lucky, because you've been taking some kind of antioxidant or something like that, right? So teaching children means that you have to be willing to say the same thing over and over and over again. And then there'll be a period of peace, and then you'll say the same thing over and over and over again. Now, here's the thing. All of us have been around kids from, you know, age 2 to 7. They don't have any trouble repeating the same thing over and over again. So it's an act of revenge for you to repeat to them over and over again what God has said. And here's the thing. Be willing to explain everything, but explain it in the context of Jesus. Explain life in the context of Jesus. Talk about why Jesus would think this is important. Talk about where the Bible says you need to do these things. Now, I want to close tonight where I started, which is with Bill. One of the things that was so cool about Bill, well, this isn't the cool part, but Bill had a lot of mental illness. And for those of us who have known him for a while, know that that was progressive. It got worse and worse. And he struggled against that. And many times on the phone with him, I talked about where he was in his life, very close to not wanting to live because of that struggle. But the thing about Bill is that he was extremely, extremely persistent. And you know that because he talks to you about movies, all of us, and he talks to us. He constantly is going, and the thing that he was so persistent about was Jesus. He loved Jesus, and he wanted everybody to know Jesus. When I was talking to his sisters, they were because they're not followers of Jesus, they're telling us how much he wanted them to know Jesus the way he knew Jesus. So when you think about parenting as a daunting task, I want you to have Bill as your patron saint of parenting. That Bill got up and he did life in a way that was in a place that was really hard for him. And he loved Jesus. And he wrote his sisters on how they should parent their children. Right? He was persistent. So let Bill be your patron saint of parenting. Let's pray.